Well, next week, Clive Myrie will be your host. He's got lots of good things up his sleeve. I hope you can tune in. He'll be here from 9 o'clock. So do take care, and I will be with you in a fortnight. Sunday Morning is a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. Thanks to my producer, Marion Bettsworth, and our studio managers in Broadcasting House, Gary Newman and Nick Scripps.
BBC Sounds.
We are constantly bombarded with adverts hyping up the latest wonder products.
This will change your life.
But what are the facts behind the fads? From collagen supplements to sad lamps, natural deodorants to fitness trackers, I am on another bunk-busting mission to test the latest consumer trends. Do these wonder products deliver? Are they really the best thing since sliced bread?
The new series of Radio 4's Sliced Bread. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday, time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the broadcaster and geneticist Adam Rutherford.
Adam Rutherford's career in science has taken him from a PhD on the role of genetics in eye development to becoming a well-known broadcaster who campaigns against pseudoscience and racism. Presenter of Radio 4's Start the Week and The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry, he's also the author of 6 best-selling books, a lecturer at University College London, and the recipient of the Royal Society David Attenborough Award for Outstanding Public Engagement with Science. I'm looking forward to talking to you more, Adam, about genetics and broadcasting. But first, music, because you brought us pieces by Bach, Beethoven, Berlioz, and your favourite band, Radiohead. You're what you might call a hard-headed scientist. So does music allow you to throw rationality to the wind and let emotion take over? Or do you have a rather rational approach to music?
It's definitely the former. Okay. All of the music that I love most, and I think what music does better than almost any other art form, is it should rattle your bones and make your heart pump. And sometimes science does that, but the reason I've chosen these tracks is because they do that every single time. In fact, the reason I was invited onto this program was because I was talking about Radiohead, and I mentioned that, in my humble opinion, there is Radiohead and Bach, and then there's other music. And I don't mind being so confident about one's opinions and absolutist when it comes to talking about music, because in science, of course, everything is nuanced and everything has to be qualified and everything's only conditionally correct. And we spend a lot of time saying, well, it might be this, but it might be that. But I think that it's more fun to say unequivocally Bach is the pinnacle of human civilization. And so is Radiohead at the same time, and then we can talk about it.
Well, we're going to start at the beginning, because you played the violin from the age of 4 and had a music scholarship at school. And I wonder whether you ever considered music as a career, or were you always focused on science?
Yes, I did consider it. We considered it in my family. I started playing the violin at the age of 4, encouraged by my dad, and I continued all throughout my school life and into my 20s. And I was good, but I wasn't that good. And there was definitely a point where, should I take this more seriously and become professional, or should it always be a thing I can be passionate about and educated about? And I chose that. And I don't regret that, because I think being a professional musician is a hard life. But I'm very grateful that I had a sort of formal musical training enough to really deeply appreciate all forms of music.
Can you listen to music and work at the same time? In other words, can you divide your brain?
I have to have music or noise, at least, when I'm writing. I find it very difficult to write in silence. And so I write in cafes, or I'm quite productive on trains, because I travel around the country a lot. The first piece of music that I've chosen for his Requiem is a piece that I discovered a few years ago when I was writing a book that I put on record. I've got it on vinyl at home. And I realised after about 4 minutes that I couldn't write to it, because it absolutely demands your full attention because it's such a perfect and sort of ethereal piece of music. So it's in this selection because it's one that stops me working.
Nigel Short conducting Tenebrae and the London Symphony Orchestra's Chamber Ensemble in that live performance of In Paradisum from Gabriel Fauré's Requiem. And by the way, that was the first choice when the Requiem last appeared on Radio 3's Building a Library. In your book, Adam Rutherford, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, you make a rather mind-blowing claim that if you are of broadly European descent, you're definitely directly descended from Charlemagne, the great 8th century Holy Roman Emperor. How did you work that out?
It's pure maths and pure logic, and it's based off... I realise this is some tricky maths and not what our listeners came here for, but there's an obvious conundrum in the way that we think about our family trees and genealogy, which is based on something very obvious but rarely pointed out, which is that everyone who's ever lived has two parents. And what that means is that if you go back through time, the number of ancestors you have doubles each generation. So you have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so on. So rapidly this becomes unsustainable, because if you go 40 generations back, which takes us about 1,000 years, the number of people on your family tree, specifically you or anyone, is about 1 trillion. Now, that's about 1,000 times more people than have ever existed, which we think is, you know, in the billions. So how can that be the case? And the answer is that family trees don't branch out eternally, expanding every generation. What happens is they begin to collapse in on themselves. And what that means is that branches of family trees begin to cross through individuals. So your great-great-great-great-grandfather might be in that position twice or three times. And the further you go back through time, the more those branches cross through the same people multiple times until you reach what's known as the identical ancestors point. And it's a very counterintuitive, but absolutely mathematically and logically true thing. And it's the identical ancestors point is the point in time where all people alive at that time are the ancestors of all people alive today. And that, for Europe, happens in about the year 1000. So Charlemagne is someone we know has living descendants today because people have done his family tree because he's royalty and we know his history well. So Charlemagne has living descendants today and he existed before the identical ancestors point. Therefore, Charlemagne is the ancestor of every single European today, including you and me and pretty much everyone listening.
Well, before we polish our halos, we perhaps ought to also wonder who else we might be associated with, less perhaps halo-worthy.
Exactly, and I think that's a really salient point because most people pass through history without leaving any trace. The further back you go, the less good records we have of people. And the reason we pick people like Charlemagne to tell these stories is because we know their histories because they were the powerful, because they were rulers. But it also means you are equally descended from Charlemagne's brother and butler and the bloke who cleaned the mud off his shoes and everyone else who was alive at that time. It's just that we don't know who those people were.
Because even if we're a redhead from the north of Scotland, we all have Chinese and African and Indian ancestors.
That's exactly right. The global identical ancestors point for everyone who's alive today, we calculate occurs at about, well, between 5 and 10,000 years ago. So it means that no matter where you are on Earth, no matter how, if you come from a tribe that has been relatively isolated in, say, South America or Papua New Guinea or Aboriginal Australian, that doesn't affect the fact that we have shared ancestry with them as recently as 4 or 5,000 years ago. And we are unequivocally and mathematically, definitely descended from all of those people at that time.
So that would mean that to a certain extent, the way we define race and its individual qualities is something of a cultural or social construct.
I would go several steps beyond that and say it is absolutely a social construct. And a lot of my work has been around trying to understand what that means. What do we mean by a social construct? Well, it's a set of guidelines or principles that are agreed effectively by consensus. And when we talk about race, we're applying socially mediated, socially consensused views, which aren't reflected in underlying biology. But the history of my field said something different. So the invention of racial categories occurs in the 19th century. And at that point, they're thinking these are fixed essential characteristics which are immutable in people. And this is the invention of race. It's not to say that pigmentation differences in populations and that were different and look different didn't exist before that. But the racial categorization we adopt today really is an invention of the 18th century. There's a question that I like to ask, and it applies particularly to people of mixed race or recent descendants of immigrants, which is, when we get asked, where are you really from? The response should be, well, when do you mean when you say that? Because it's a funny sort of coded way of saying, why do you look a little bit different from everyone else I've grown up with? And often it's well-intentioned. Mm. You know, you look different and that's fun. That's interesting. Often it's racistly coded, where are you really from? And people like me, I'm of mixed heritage, used to get it a lot when we were growing up, less so as an adult, but it does still happen. Occasionally, just last year, a taxi driver said, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from Ipswich, but I live in Dulwich now. And he said, but where are you really from? And I don't know how to answer that I am from Ipswich and now I live in Dulwich is the correct answer. But what he really is asking is, why do you look like the way you do? Why is your skin darker than mine?
Well, one thing that expresses our common humanity is indeed music, and some pieces in particular. Your next choice, for example, Kyung-hwa Chung performing Beethoven's Violin Concerto, is surely one of those.
Well, as a violinist, to have a virtuoso violin concerto, there were so many to choose from, and I expect all of your guests say it was so hard to choose, but I think the Beethoven is the one that soars above all others. No, it was never good enough to come anywhere near attempting to play it. And of the people to play it, I grew up at a time when I think my dad was listening to Kyung-hwa Chung a lot, and this was the one that I feel is the most sort of visceral and has a sort of gruntiness to its virtuosity, which I really like. It's very impassioned, and you know, I listen to it almost with gritted teeth because it's so beautiful.
Thank you.
A few years ago when I was presenting a programme on Radio 4 called Inside Science, and we'd covered an academic paper which was to do with the evolution of the sound holes on violins. And it was a lovely, you know, slightly quirky study to do. And we played some of the Beethoven that we just heard with Kyung Hwa Chung playing it. And there was a sort of discussion on Twitter about this. And I, you know, Twitter can so often be just a sewer of awful expression of views. But this was one of those occasions which showed how wonderful social media can be. Someone asked me what violin she was using. And I didn't know. And I didn't contact her or anything, but her name was in the tweet. And I said, I don't know whether she was using a Stradivarius or not. And she replied, and she said, yes, I was, and this was the violin that I was using. So I had this amazing moment where, having listened to her all my life, she suddenly popped up and said, yep, that's the answer to that question. Thanks very much.
Kyung Hwa Chung, with music from the first movement of Beethoven's Violin Concerto in D, Klaus Tennstedt, conducting the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra. That was a recording from 1989. Do you feel in some ways that racism, instead of getting better, has actually got worse, and partially because of things like social media?
What social media and what the changing political atmosphere in the last 10 years or so with the rise of populism, I think what it's done has exposed what people thought secretly or privately. And so the schisms in our country and around the world have been laid bare. That I wrote a little bit about this in one of my books, which How to Argue with a Racist, it's called, slightly pugnacious title. But I think there was a sense, especially amongst the middle classes, that during the 80s and into the 90s, that racism had sort of gone away. And that with the advent of a much more racially aware society, the old racisms or interpersonal racisms of calling people particular racial epithets or specific abusive names, that had all gone. It became socially unacceptable. But it didn't mean, and I think that's what's been exposed in the 21st century, it didn't mean that racism had gone away. And many people still harbour either specifically racist views, so interpersonal racism, but also there's been a much bigger exposure of structural racism in societies, that there are these implicit, often undiscussed and unrecognised biases that institutions have and that people have, and they're not about calling people names, or they're not necessarily about identifying specific physical characteristics of different people of different ancestry around the world. But they're ideas that are so baked into our culture from several hundred years' worth of structural racism and imperial dominance that everyone thinks them. Black people are better at sport or dancing. People from East Asia are better at maths. Chinese people are hardworking but uncreative. All those sorts of things. Sometimes they're what we refer to as positive attribute racism, so traits that you might like to have, to be more sporty or better at dancing. But as a scientist, you have to approach those questions and say, well, one, are they true? And as a historian, you have to say, are they true? And is holding that view reinforcing a cultural stereotype or racist epithet that has existed for hundreds of years? And in almost all cases, the answer to those questions is it's untrue and yes.
Now we come to your favourite band, already mentioned by you, Radiohead. What have you chosen from them?
I could easily have chosen 8 or possibly 15 Radiohead songs. But the one I've chosen is called How to Disappear Completely. And I think it's quite a maudlin song, which I like. I enjoy tracks that are sad or thoughtful. But it has a moment in it which I think is a moment of musical perfection. I think about how Leonard Bernstein talked about how music should build pressure and then release it. And this idea that you are focused as this mounting sense of whatever emotion that the music is trying to convey. In this case, it's almost dread. But then as it is released, it's heavenly. And at the end of the middle 8 section of this song, How to Disappear Completely, it does exactly that in what I think is one of the great moments in modern music.
that's not me. I go where I please. I walk through walls. I float down. happening.
Radiohead with How to Disappear Completely from their album Kid A. Adam Rutherford, you've been very prominent in the humanist movement for a long time and recently became president of Humanists UK. How do you get the public to engage with humanism? How do you make it a positive thing rather than simply anti-religion?
Humanism isn't anti-religion, and I think that it's a characterisation which is something that we have to slightly contest. Humanism is a very positive movement, and as society moves away from the formal church, which is happening more and more, and I think most people in the most recent censuses, the majority of people in the UK don't describe themselves as being religious, there's been a sort of sense of that being replaced by a slightly fuzzy, an acceptably fuzzy term, which is people thinking of themselves as being spiritual. Mm. And you know, it's not always clear what you mean by that, but that's obviously a very strong human trait. And so talking about humanism as a movement which is positive, and it's about, you know, the phrase that we use is think for yourself and act for everyone. So it's a global movement which is based on rationality and compassion and kindness, which are many of the traits of organized religion over the last several thousand years. We do it in humanism without the supernatural, with a reliance on a naturalistic and empirical view of the world. So it's pro-science, and we reject supernatural explanations. But it's a positive movement. It's about community and support and compassion and kindness. But I'm quite happy for religions to exist, or other ways of knowing and being to exist in parallel. The problems arise when one steps on the toes of the other. Mm. and claims ownership of knowledge, or claims that stories and legends that are there to help us understand who we are and help us understand who humankind is and the human condition, if they are asserted as being historical truths or facts when the data says otherwise.
Mm. Now we come to the opening of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier.
Yes. When the Voyager spaceship was being put together, the first interplanetary spaceship, and there's a gold disc on it, and there was a discussion, I think it was between Carl Sagan and others, about what music to represent humankind you would put on this gold disc, so that if aliens had a nice turntable, they would they would drop the needle on it and go, hey, these guys aren't so bad. But the discussion went, well, shouldn't we just fill it with Bach? And the response is, well, that would just be showing off.
That's very good. And actually, you've gone one better than simply playing the Well-Tempered Clavier as we would normally hear it, but as we might hear it on Approaching Heaven.
If I believed in heaven, which I don't, yeah, then this, I think, is what you would hear.
Because it's a version for harp, isn't
it? Yes, it almost feels cheating or possibly cliched to do this, but it's perfection, and then it's one notch above that.
Thank you.
perfection with the cherry on top. Andrea Wieg, the harpist, performing the opening prelude from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Book One by Johann Sebastian Bach. And you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Adam Rutherford, on the Private Passions website. And of course, if you go to BBC Sounds, you can always enjoy hundreds of previous editions of the programme. You're a very busy man, Adam, many passions, not just music, but cricket, film. And I think one of the things that really you feel strongly about is the snobbery that exists in certain quarters about film music.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's exactly right. I think it was Howard Goodall who said that people who said that classical music died in the 19th century hadn't been watching movies. Yeah. I may have misattributed that. But
or hadn't been watching Blackadder and Mr. Bean, for which he wrote the music.
He did. That is absolutely true. And I know that a lot of film music, and film music that is regarded as classic, is heavily derived from pre-existing pieces by classical composers. I think about the soundtrack to Gladiator, which is very popular, and it's almost a sort of facsimile of Mars from the planets. But however you get into music, I don't think people should be judgmental about that. I've become an anti-taxonomist. So classification, we like to put things in boxes. We like to say this is what a thing is and this is what a different thing is, and those two things are different. This is classical music.
But that's exactly, of course, what people like Radiohead are dispelling, aren't they? Because they're using, contemporary music sounds, whether it be Stockhausen, people like that, as well as pop, bass guitar and all the rest. So, I mean, those lines are all blurred now, aren't they?
I do hope so, because I think that if you want music to have this visceral, emotional trigger for you, if you want to feel moved, if you want your bones to rattle in your chest, which I do, then it shouldn't matter whether it's the Well-Tempered Clavier on the harp, or Led Zeppelin or Taylor Swift.
We're going to hear music from the 2018 science fiction film Annihilation, starring Natalie Portman. And I think you had a role on this, didn't you?
I did. One of the things I'm most proud of is that for the last few years, I've done quite a lot of film consultation. So as a scientist, talking to scriptwriters and actors and directors about the representation of science in their scripts and their performances. And I've been working with the director, Alex Garland, since his film Ex Machina. The film that we made after that was called Annihilation, and it's got a lot of genetics in it. It's science fiction, it's got an alien in it, although it's never really describes or manifests itself. But the reason I chose this is because this soundtrack is integral to the film. It doesn't accompany the story of the film. And the bit we're about to hear is the first expression of the alien itself. It's the first time we see the physical manifestation of the alien, which is very abstract and difficult for us to process. But the music and what is on the soundtrack is the vocalization of this alien creature.
Thank you. The Alien, music by Ben Salisbury and Jeff Barrow, from their arresting soundtrack to Annihilation, the 2018 film. Adam Rutherford, you caught COVID at the very beginning of the pandemic, which became, I think, long COVID, and you have talked publicly about the effect it had on you. What were your symptoms?
Well, not that much fun, to be perfectly honest. So I was an early adopter of COVID. I got it on the 13th of March 2020, right at the beginning, before there were tests. Mm. And in fact, I was on, as a Radio 4 regular, I was on the Today programme on the Wednesday, I think it was, talking to Martha Carney, when I was sort of slightly coughing. I was, you know, part of the Radio 4 family, so what's it actually like to have it? And I was going, well, I feel pretty rough. I've got a bit of a throat, you know, a bit of a cough. And I think the last thing I said in that interview was, but I think it'll pass in a couple of days. A week later, we had ambulances coming, although I never was hospitalised and should have been, as I'd reached as close to shuffling off this mortal coil as I've ever been. Antibiotics cured it. Antibiotics which only work on bacteria, and this is a viral infection, but I had the misfortune of having pneumonia at the same time, which also was not that much fun.
So your oxygen sats were not particularly good.
84, if that means anything to the listeners.
Yes.
You generally get hospitalised at 90.
Yeah.
I describe it as suboptimal. But the symptoms, the long COVIDness of it, which I now am very grateful to say have completely passed, lasted more than a year. And at first it was just sort of a sort of tiredness and fatigue. Fatigue is not the same as tiredness. And then as I was getting fitter, I was working quite hard at it and took a lot of time off during that summer and started playing cricket again. But interestingly discovered that I couldn't go up hills. So I could play on the flat and I could cycle and I could weight train, which I like doing. But if any slight incline, and our bedroom is three floors up in our house, I'd have to have a sit down halfway. Mm. That mercifully has gone now.
How do people like you counter the tsunami of pseudoscience and conspiracy theories that spread on social media, in particular about COVID?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose you just try. You try to offer a rational worldview, to look at the evidence, to look at the sources of information. I also think that we amplify the voices of miscreants or people who have political agendas that oppose, for example, vaccination, possibly the most effective medical intervention ever invented. And social media has a very strong effect for amplifying the peripheral voices. And I suppose the best way to counter them is just to expose better ways of thinking. One of the biggest problems that science, particularly biology, faces is that it's often what is true is not experiential or is not based on what people think is their own personal experience. So you get a lot of pushback from saying, well, people, you know, I think this feels wrong. I've explained some bit of complex genetics, like, for example, blue eyes and brown eyes are not Mendelian in the way that we're taught at school, which they're not, by the way. If you're doing your GCSEs and listening, please answer the question as it's written in your textbooks. But that often runs counter to people's lived experience. But science is not there to make us feel warm and fuzzy or to confirm our biases. It's there to disabuse us of our intuition, because intuition is a really bad way of understanding how things are rather than how that we perceive them to be.
We heard film music just now by Jeff Barrow, and I think he introduced you to the next musician. And rather wonderfully, it's not an instrument we hear that frequently, because we're going to hear the Serbian accordion player and composer Mario Batković.
Yes, that's right. So Jeff and Ben were doing the soundtrack to another Alex Garland project, a series, in fact, which is called Devs, which came out a couple of years ago. And I'm sitting in the edit suite with them and they were putting music together. And Mario Batković is signed to Jeff Barrow's label, Invader Records. And there was a scene in which I'd never come across him before, but they'd used his music. And they ended up not using it in the final cut, so it's not in the series itself.
That often happens.
It does. But I listened to the music and thought, this is quite astonishing. And his story is astonishing as well, that he's come from this long and very serious tradition of accordion playing, but has sort of moved aside and has become a sort of heretic of Serbian accordion playing. But it's, again, it's that thing that I think I've mentioned a couple of times. It's really visceral. And the fact that you can hear the mechanics of the keys, I love.
Quartere, which means to shake or agitate, played by the accordionist Mario Batkovich, performing his own 2015 composition. Adam, I wonder, now having children of your own, you've got three, has it changed the way you think about genetics and indeed your own genetics?
What an interesting question. Well, I think I've been asked that before, which is... Thinking about it now is it's odd that it's the first time I've been asked that. I'm not sure. Genetics is incredibly important in inheritance. Obviously, it is where our biological inheritance is kept. But I think it's so often overstated that we have a culturally normalized view of what I refer to as monogenic biological determinism, which means that we identify genes and that gene is passed on and you will have that trait. It's determined. It determines your behaviour. One of the things that we've learned in genetics over the last 50 years or so is that these things are just not true. They're not true at all. But our desire as humans to have narrative satisfaction in our stories about individuals, about families and about nations and cultures heavily relies on this form of genetic determinism. So I think in answer to your question, I see our biological similarities and I don't attribute their good characteristics to my genes.
Or indeed their bad ones.
Oh, no, the bad ones are definitely me.
Well, look, we're going to end by going back to your school days in Suffolk when you might or might not have been a bad boy for your final piece of music, a piece you played with the school orchestra, the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, wonderful piece of orchestration. What memories does this conjure up for you, good and bad?
It's so special, this, not just because it's an enormous amount of fun, but this was special for me because it was the first and only time that I played first desk. I was the leader of the school orchestra, but for this performance, I played first desk, and the leader was my teacher, Wendy Brown, who I know listens to this programme, so I hope you're listening right now. But to play alongside your teacher, who I loved, was such a special thing to do. And it's great fun. This is rock music.
This is the last movement, Dream of a Witch's Sabbath. And your story about playing this with your teacher is a very nice note on which to end. So, Adam Rutherford, thank you very much.
It's been an absolute privilege and an honour to be here.
last movement of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique with Sir Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions, Adam Rutherford. The programme was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. As ever, you can find details of all of today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael Barclay's guest will be the structural engineer Roma Agrawal. Very good afternoon from me, John Shea. Welcome to BBC Radio 3 if you've just joined us. In a couple of minutes, today's lunchtime concert. But first, at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC news. There's been a wave of demonstrations in cities across China against the government's strict anti-COVID policies. Some protesters have been calling for President Xi Jinping to step down in a rare display of anger at the restrictions. Thousands of protesters have turned out in Shanghai, where the BBC has seen people bundled into police cars. China continues to pursue a zero COVID policy with snap lockdowns to control any outbreaks. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, has rejected suggestions that the government is blocking efforts to reach a pay deal to prevent further rail strikes. He said there had been a lot of progress in talks between the unions and train operators and that it wasn't in the government's interest to jeopardise that. But Mr Harper insisted inflation-matching pay increases were not affordable. 4 48-hour strikes are currently planned for the railways across December and January. Posting on the internet to encourage people to self-harm is going to be made a criminal offence in an update to the Online Safety Bill. The government said the changes had been influenced by the case of 14-year-old Molly Russell, who ended her life in November 2017. The NSPCC welcomed the change, but said more needed to be done to create a culture of compliance and accountability at social media companies. The BBC understands there have been more than 50 cases of the highly contagious infection diphtheria among asylum seekers who've recently arrived in the UK. It was confirmed yesterday that a man who died after being held at the Manston Centre in Kent had contracted the disease. Rescue teams in Italy are searching for about a dozen people missing after a huge mudslide on the island of Ischia. Rivers of mud and debris hurtled down the hills after a deluge of rain. The Italian government is expected to approve a state of emergency and give money to help rebuild damaged homes. Millions of people across Ukraine are battling to cope with power cuts and no heating in freezing temperatures. Ukraine's emergency services are trying to fix the damage caused by Russian missile attacks. The capital, Kyiv, has been badly affected. At the Men's Football World Cup in Qatar, Japan have suffered a costly defeat. They lost 1-0 to Costa Rica, who've kept alive their chances of reaching the knockout stages. Germany take on Spain later today. Belgium are now playing Morocco. And the weather. It'll be a breezy afternoon with showers in the northwest spreading southwards later. Rain will linger in the far southeast, but it will be drier with